This is Ecotopia on Key ZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological. On this program, we've often worried about pessimism regarding climate change, and a number of our guests have argued that in varying degrees, the Earth is past various tipping points.
Our guest tonight, Harriet Sugarman, argues that despite the severity of the crisis, we owe it to our children to address it directly and truthfully with them. And she has powerful ideas about how to talk with kids and engage them in environmental action.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous support of our listeners. Thank you. And by the COVID-conscious Chico Certified Farmers Markets, with year-round markets Wednesday mornings at the North Valley Plaza, Saturdays at 3 at Wall and 3rd and in downtown Chico. Chico Certified Farmers Markets, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. We want to remind you that the opinions expressed on Ecotopia do not necessarily express the views of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, volunteers, underwriters, or programmers. We'll talk with Harriet Sugarman in a few moments. Here are the Dixie Chicks performing a lullaby, and they ask, "How long do you want to be loved? Is forever enough?"
They didn't have you where I come from. Never knew the best was yet to come. Life began when I saw your face.
You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. Our guest tonight is Harriet Sugarman. She's an activist who is focusing on telling children the truth about climate change and then engaging them in climate action. Harriet has had a long career working as a policy analyst and economist both in Canada and at the United Nations, where she worked on the first United Nations Earth Summit.
In 2007, she participated in the Climate Reality Project, sponsored by Al Gore, and she now focuses most of her attention on Climate Mama, where mamas and papas work to educate children about climate change. Her recent book from New Society is How to Talk to Your Kids About Climate Change, Turning Angst into Action. Welcome, Harriet Sugarman.
Thank you so much. It's truly my pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you. Let's start with Climate Mama. What is Climate Mama? How did it start? What's its mission? Who's involved? Tell us a little bit about what you do.
Great. Thanks. Thanks for asking. Well, as you mentioned, I did the climate reality training with Al Gore back in 2007, and it was such an inspiring and one of those kind of aha moments in your life where you think, wow, I've learned so much. What am I going to do with it? And I came back, and I had was living in the suburbs with two little kids, was just finishing up my job on this big stage and really in this community with parents at this new school, and realizing that the people that I was meeting really didn't understand how urgent the climate crisis was. And in all, you know, respects, even though I had worked on our climate crisis, but from this really global level, I didn't even realize before that how it impacted me as a parent, what I needed to teach my kids. And I started looking online for resources to help me put things in the words that I could talk to other parents, as well as better able to inform my children, and I couldn't find anything. So it took me a couple years after the training, but I established Climate Mama. We were, I believe, the first at that time parent-focused organization that was looking at the reality of the climate crisis, the science, ways to talk to our kids, trying to identify other parents that were doing things so we could share best practices. So that was sort of the idea behind the organization, and I did it. It was online, and I have to say it was, I'm sure that when I looked at the back end in those days, that I would see who, you know, where people were coming to the website from, I was pretty sure I knew who those people were, that they were either from my neighborhood or back in Alberta where I was from, or it was
friends and neighbors.
There weren't that many, and now we have tens of thousands of people that come to the site from all over the world, and it's been a real adventure over the past 10 years.
So who all's involved in it? You're the spearhead. Are you the full-time worker?
Exactly. Yes. I am the founder and the executive director.
Okay. Right.
Over the last 11 years of Climate Mama, there have been other people involved on a full-time, on a part-time basis. Now, over the last couple years, I really work on a project basis, so we'll team up with other organizations or other groups and work on a project basis. But we don't have a big staff. We're not a big organization. We're nimble and fast-moving, but really sort of a central clearinghouse, a place for people to come for information. I like to tell people my personal superpower, I think, is connecting people and connecting organizations that then go on to do big things.
Can you tell us about some of the projects that you've created or are now working on?
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, we've sort of run the gamut from helping schools and organizations build rain gardens and outdoor classrooms to helping parents have their voices heard that are on the front lines of fossil fuel extraction programs. So we've worked on communities where they're building compressor stations and pipelines to working on education campaigns. I currently am working with a group called Our Kids Climate that was formed last year. We launched at the United Nations in May of 2019, and I serve as an advisor there, and Climate Mama helps to bring other parent groups from around the world. We have over 50 now that are coming to learn strategies for reaching parents in their countries to talk about the climate crisis. So it's really rewarding to help others that so they don't have to recreate the wheel, and to use some of the programs that we've used to share with them and to see what's happening, you know, the similarities and the differences between parent voices in India or Nigeria or the UK or the Netherlands or, you know, different parts here in the United States or in Canada.
And people can learn more about that at www.climatemama.com. So I'm sure they'll find more on your website.
They will. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a really good website. All kinds of info there. Harriet Sugarman, you open your book, How to Talk to Your Kids About Climate Change. You say in the opening pages, let's begin by telling our children the truth. And you immediately drop your words, the climate change bomb. That's pretty harsh opening. What's the truth bomb? And with all the bad stuff going on in the world, including COVID-19, how can we lay the truth on our kids and our grandchildren?
Such good questions, and a lot packed in there, for sure.
Yeah,
and
we can take our time, too.
Yeah, thanks. And, you know, our motto at Climate Mama, which has guided me and guided the organization over the last 10 years, is that and these are lessons, I think, that many of us were taught by our parents. We teach our kids, they're broadly based, to tell the truth, that actions speak louder than words, and to not be afraid. And I try to frame the book around those large premises and telling the truth about the climate crisis. You know, we can pretend it's not happening, we can look the other way, but we know it, we feel it, we see it around us. Scientists are telling us it's happening, and it's happening to all of us in different ways, certainly. But our kids are feeling it. They're seeing it. They're seeing extreme weather events. They're seeing families and friends that are impacted by our climate crisis. They're seeing people's jobs change because of it. And so to try to minimize it, because this is something, the climate crisis, as you well know, and I know you both spend a lot of time thinking about this and, you know, talking to lots of people and mm-hmm. really informed questions and thoughtfulness around it. We're going to be living this crisis for the rest of our lives. Mm-hmm. And as I say in the book, we need to get comfortable with that uncomfortable truth. And it's going to be different depending on how old our kids are, how we share that with them. But that is the reality. And in some ways, for people maybe just coming into understanding the realities, it's like dropping a bomb, because how can that be, right? There must be things we can do, and that's also what I hope people take away from the book, is that there are things we can do. But the fact that we have changed our planet, we have entered the Anthropocene, the age of man, the age of humans, we are the strongest forcing agents on our planet, we have changed how our planet acts. We put her out of balance. And those are heavy words and hard for many people to imagine, that we as a singular species have been that powerful. But in fact, we have. And that's some ways awe-inspiring, in some ways, you know, it's terrifying.
It's
the truth. So
right.
I think we start from there.
You talk about getting off the backs of dinosaurs. What are the dinosaurs, and why are we having so much trouble with this?
Yeah, such a good question. Again, you know, we are addicted to fossil fuels, for many reasons and many complicated reasons, and we could probably spend the rest of the night talking about mm-hmm. that. But as a metaphor in terms of talking about how for millions of years the fossil fuels have been stored underground, and we're now pulling them out at a rate and pace and using them to fuel modernization, to fuel our lives. And, you know, when we started doing that back in the 1800s, that was a good thing, right? It advanced modern science, it advanced modern medicine, it gave us tools and equipment that we didn't have otherwise, but we didn't realize the implications of that and what that would do to our atmosphere, what that would actually do in changing our planet. And so we have been riding on the backs of these fossil fuels for these dinosaurs for a really long time, but we can't stay there, and we know that, but that's a really hard thing to move us beyond.
How do science and politics shape our views of the fossil fuel problem? I mean, we have still incredible numbers of particularly political people who are climate deniers. So how is that impacting us?
Yeah, you know what? It's also such a good point and a good place to talk from, because the science is clear, right?
Right.
We can't well, we have climate deniers per se, but, you know, the overwhelming body of evidence, the peer-reviewed data, the 99 scientists out of the one that says something else, tell us that climate change is here, it's happening, it's bad, we've caused it, but there are things we can do about it. But how we address it, so the science is clear, and the message from scientists is clear, and we can't refute that, but how we deal with it in terms of policy, what we do with that information, how serious the policies are that we develop in advance to address what the science is telling us is happening, really has become a partisan issue, and it's different in different localities and different states. So the politics and the science aren't always aligned in the urgency of the crisis that we face.
You write at some length about the Paris climate talks, and we'd be interested, given your experience in the UN, to see where you think we stand at that moment, quite aside perhaps from Mr. Trump's arbitrarily withdrawing us from the agreement. Are there international agreements like the Paris talks that hold out some hope for us?
Yeah, you know, I worked for many, many years at the UN, and as you said, was involved in that very first, well, there were meetings before that, but the 1992 Earth Summit, where we really, you know, the world came together at the head of state level to say that climate change was a crisis, we needed to address it. And then one of the mechanisms or the body that was evolved, that came out of that 1992 conference meeting, was the Conference of the Parties, which meet on a regular basis. And that Paris Agreement was from one of those COPs, those Conference of the Parties. But, you know, and again, the world said, you know, it was successful. We came together. We said we're going to work as hard as we can to keep temperatures below this threshold of a rise of 2 degrees. And if we can, we're going to do it, keep it below 1.5 degrees. And again, we can talk about those nuances, which are huge, actually, the differences there. But really, the Paris Agreement was non-binding, and it was none of these climate agreements are binding in that there's no enforcement mechanism. And we, as countries, because countries make up those bodies, come together, and we brought our own climate agreement. Each country developed their own agreement, brought it to Paris, and then it's now up to every country every 5 years to show they're tightening it up, they're making it stronger. And so, even we in the U.S., President Obama at the time, who came to Paris, came with something that he thought would, he'd be able to work with here, knowing how difficult it was even then getting anything agreed to with Paris, with Congress. So, you know, it's something that we can hold up and say we all came together and agreed this is really serious, this is really bad. But scientists tell us, and even policymakers, that if every country met their Paris commitments, we still would see a rise in temperature upwards of 3 to 4 to 5 degrees. So it's not enough, Paris. It was a start. It has to be tighter. I think the hope to take away from that is that, you know, the moral suasion of governments on each other, and not only that, but us as organizations, as individuals, to say you agreed to this, you recognize the seriousness of the problem. We need to do something because you've told us it's really serious. And so for my experience working at the United Nations, that is the power of the United Nations, where all these countries can meet, can discuss global issues, recognize there are things we can do, but ultimately there, you know, it's a body that doesn't have any enforcement power, doesn't have that kind of teeth, that is reliant on us as a nation and as organizations, states, etc., that make up that nation, to see that those commitments are implemented and we take it farther. So it's there. You know, I have to say that when I was working in the UN and working on these agreements, and we'd stay up till 3 a.m. and fight about an and or an ah or a but or a comma, I didn't recognize, to me, it didn't feel so important, and stepping away from it and having the benefit of being able to stand back and be at the grassroots level now, it's really important, because then it's something we hold the country responsible for implementing. So Paris, in that way, yes, it was important, but it didn't. It left it to each country to do its own work and hard work on the climate.
In your book, How to Talk to Your Kids About Climate Change, you express optimism, including a quote from Christiana Figueres: "Optimism is not the result of changing the world, but the route to doing so." And this is a huge question for me. This is a personal question. How do you square optimism with the truth about the climate disaster?
Yeah, it's a big one. But, and you know, Christiana Figueres also just has a book coming out, had a book just coming out exactly on that as well, too, about being the optimist. And I think that as we've heard from science, scientists are telling us there still is time. And we have seen in this strange moment that we're in now with COVID-19 how quickly the planet can heal herself in different ways. It's not making climate pollution disappear. We know CO2's up there for decades and centuries, but healing of air pollution, of many things, you know, people are talking about it the world over. And it, to your point of finding optimism, there's a planet telling us, you know what, give her a chance. She's such an evolved, you know, the planet is this very complicated system that exists. But, and we've definitely broken parts of those systems, and we're pushing out on those planetary boundaries. But we don't know how fast the planet can heal. We don't know when we use, you know, regenerative agriculture, when we use methods that help the planet then come back stronger in a healthier way, how fast that happens. So I think we, you know, and we see examples, we see glimpses of that. We are seeing a glimpse of that now. And that needs to build our optimism. I believe strongly that can build our hope. That should give us it, just that belief that if we work hard, if we actually are conscious and intentional about what we're doing, we don't know how fast the planet will heal. So I know, you know, you talked about climate deniers in the beginning, and in the book I also mentioned on the other side those climate doomers, and you know, we talked about that climate bomb and some of David Wallace Wells' work, you know, that we're way farther down the road, and we can look at the worst case scenario and see we'll never get there, or we can choose to say we don't have to, you know, do nothing. There are things we can do that can slow down our climate crisis, and then nobody can tell us for certain. So we need to have that optimism, that hope that it will get better.
Let's transition to talk how to talk about kids. Your book talks about four facts that we need to tell kids. Could you give us a sense of what those facts are, and then we want to get into how we actually talk to kids about them?
Sure, yeah. So, you know, these four basic premises that I think all of our kids, regardless of age, can understand, too, that what's happening isn't normal. So what the changes we put in place, that we're putting in place, it's not normal. Yet, as we just talked about, it's still within our control. That's what science is telling us. We can slow down the changes. And then the big one, I think, that's really important, not only for our kids, but for us to remember, is that it doesn't rest on their shoulders alone or on ours. And I think sometimes, especially in the past few years, where we've seen young people speak out and we've seen people really listen and hear young people's voices in a way that I think we haven't perhaps in the past, even though they've been there, many young people, I think, are feeling this intense pressure that, that solving the climate crisis rests on their shoulders. And I think reminding them that's not the case. And reminding ourselves, or when we hear that from our peers, oh, you know, the kids got this now. Well, that's unfair. They don't. They shouldn't have to, because we can all still vote. We can all take action. We can all do things. And so I think there are many more people that are coming to this realization. So I think as the fourth fact, just reminding them of that, that's critical.
There's also a lot of anger there, I think. I've been confronted by young people in their 20s or 30s. I'm in my 70s. Mm-hmm. Who say, you guys had your chance. It's over. It's on our shoulders now. We can't depend on you any further. And that's a difficult one to respond to. Even as we want to say in our 70s, we want to continue to work on the issues. But 30 years down the road, it is going to be on their shoulders.
Sure. Yes, of course, because that's just how life works, right? But you, especially, both of you, bringing all these issues to people's attention, making sure people hear what's happening and have hope. You know, there are different people that work on things in different ways. And so I think that that mantra of, you know, the angry young person, there are, and fair enough, they should be angry too. You know, it's, I share a story in my book about my father who passed away 5 years ago from throat cancer, and then who was a lifelong smoker. And, you know, he, when he started smoking in the 50s, it was this, you know, beautiful commercials of how, you know, amazing people all with cigarettes in their mouths. And, mm-hmm. you know, we, so again, a lot of what we did as to perpetuate or to move forward this climate crisis, we should have known, but we didn't know, because there was so much hiding of the science, of the people that did know it. And now, I mean, yes, it's peer-reviewed, there's so much information, but to put the blame squarely on, you know, those of us who are adults now, we can still demand action. We can still demand change. We can work. Mm-hmm. Intergenerational work on climate is critical, I think, that we work with young people, that we listen to them. We take new ideas from them. They learn and are informed by what we've tried to do, what worked, what didn't work, and that we teach each other. So I think there's, you know, when we hear that, that we can push back and just say, well, show me, you know, tell me, I want to help, I want to be part of it. And yes, maybe we won't be here in 30 years, but we've got 30 good years ahead of us to continue the work.
Equally important is how we tell kids. You have a number of narratives in your book from parents who've talked to their kids, and these include success stories as well as discussion of problems or reservations. Could you please give us some specific examples of how we go about talking to children? And, of course, it it varies from age to age. A preschooler, and we have 9-year-old granddaughters, and middle school and high school. How do you go about it?
Right. Well, I think that that first important point that you brought out is that it will be different. There isn't one answer that is a way to talk to our kids, because it's going to be age dependent. You know your grandchildren or your children better than anyone. You know what they're going to be able to accept or not. And then they probably will surprise you, because they're probably already hearing about things, talking about things with their friends. If they're old enough, on social media or on the internet, they're searching out answers themselves, some of them as well, too. So there are different scenarios and different ways to reach out to kids at different at times, and to alleviate some of that fear, and how we share, you know, that there are many people working on issues, etc. So, again, it's age-dependent. It should be place-based, right? In the Central Valley in California, there are examples you're going to be able to talk about in terms of water scarcity and terms of food security that may be different from me on the East Coast, where I might be talking more about sea level rise, or you know, maybe we both talk about forest fire. You know, there are very specific examples, and I think that all of those come initially too with educating ourselves. This is a big topic, and there's lots of great resources. And I, in the book, you know, one of the very first things, and we've talked about that a little bit already too, is that we need to understand what we're talking about so that we're comfortable with sharing those specific examples with our children. And, you know, you talked about what are some of those specifics. So if you have very young kids, preschool or early elementary, well, you know, you're going to read to them. You're going to share stories. You're going to take them for walks in nature. Maybe you're going to take them to a farm, or maybe you have space to grow a garden. You're going to do things that expose them to nature, encourage that love of nature. You're not going to go down this, you know, direct hard road that you might with your middle school kids or your high school kids. At any age, you can develop a climate action plan. You can have young kids help on that, middle school, high school, and elementary school. You know, what are very specific things you can do around your own home and your own family and your neighborhood? So get them to come up with ideas. And what are things you can do this week, next month, next year, and visit that on a weekly basis or a regular basis? Think about visiting the state capitol, writing a letter to a elected official, your town mayor, drawing a picture if they're a young child of what's important to them, taking them, you know, when we can do that again, to marches and rallies, letting them see and hear other young people that are their age. The idea of efficacy, of being empowered by feeling you can make a difference. So reminding our kids, because we're showing them other kids actually are making a difference in their communities, even if they're too young to vote, even if they're just in grade school, that people are listening to them. And there's, again, great resources that are easily accessible. I have lists in the back of my book, but there are many places to get them that you can show your kids, other kids that are doing things that are making a difference in their own community that then can be replicated in your community. So there are many things that we can show our kids. They can have hope, they can feel empowered, and that they can build on what they're passionate about to take those actions.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and our guest is Harriet Sugarman, author of a book from New Society entitled How to Talk to Your Kids About Climate Change. In the past couple of months of sheltering in place, parents have been taking a very active hand in their children's educations, and over the summer, and quite possibly into the fall, parents and teachers will be looking for learning experiences for their kids. And so we think that parents will find lots of ideas from Harriet's book, the subtitle is Turning Angst into Action. So what's your theory and practice of creating hope through action? You just talked about it a little bit, but we'd like to hear lots more.
Thanks. Yes, I really strongly believe that through our actions that we can build up our hope, and through being around other people who believe that, who are taking actions, also can be so empowering and so inspiring as well, because you know, we can have hope on things, and we should, but hope by itself, in a vacuum, is just that. And, you know, Joanna Macy is someone who I follow and quote in the book in terms of her definition of active hope, and that it's something she talks about it also as a practice, as you said, as something like Tai Chi or gardening or something that we have to grow, that we have to tend, that we have to take care of. And then we have to look for the reality clearly of what we're hoping to accomplish. How, where do we want to go? And what steps will take us to get there? And so, you know, we may want to solve the climate crisis, yet we know we're never going to solve it, right? We're going to live with it for the rest of our lives, as we've spoken about. But how can we make it less worse? How do we envision and vision that future for our grandchildren, that now for our children? What steps are we going to take, one at a time, right? And some of us can take giant leaps because of where we work, where, you know, the organizations we're involved with. And some of us, you know, we're working hard in our own homes and in our own jobs, and we can just put one foot in front of the other. But each one can be powerful. And I think, too, that hope, you know, we never know who is it that's listening to your show right now that's going to hear something that's going to inspire them to then say something or do something that takes that next step. And we might not know that, but we've been able to empower or inspire. And I think we need to derive hope from all of those things, but they come with action. So I think you putting those two together, action and hope, and active hope, I think that's so important.
You talked a little bit earlier about the elementary school kids, preschool kids, and I sense you're taking a softer approach there, introducing them to nature, taking them on walks, family gardens, and so forth. Then we get to the transescence. I used to love middle school kids, and as I age, I discover I'm less and less patient with them. What can you do with those troublesome middle school kids?
Right. That age where they just know it all, right?
Yes.
They know everything, mm-hmm. and they're experimenting with everything. And I think that, you know, we need to ask them, you know, what are their thoughts about this? And I think it can surprise us. And some of them, you know, will, and many at that age, right, too, it's what their peers are thinking and what their peers are doing. So what are their peers doing, and how do they see these issues being part of their lives? And I think, again, that whole place-based thing is, are there things that are happening in their school, in their community? And as you said, some kids will be more interested in others, and we have to recognize not all of them will be, and not every child, whether they're in elementary school or middle school, high school or beyond, is going to be that one that's going to be up at the mic, that's going to be rallying other kids. Some kids will take it from a quiet perspective, from a science perspective. So again, even with those middle school kids, you know, they're curious. They challenge them if they are telling you something to actually find the facts on that. Challenge them to figure out a way to reduce your energy at home. How would you do that? I had a friend once who set up a program where he worked with electric companies to give a green allowance. Well, can you, you know, that unfortunately didn't follow through, or maybe it was a thought before its time. But are there ways that, you know, your kids can help you save money around the house through climate initiatives, and maybe they get an allowance through that? So there's ways to bring them in, even at that more challenging age, I think.
Having dissed the middle school kids, I have to report a positive experience. I work at a local wildflower charter school, and we invited Sunrise Movement people, college students and older from Chico, to come talk with them. As a result of that presentation, the middle schoolers started to have colloquia, and many of them are keeping climate change diaries, just recording their response to what's going on. And Susan, I hope to be able to record some of those climate change diaries and put them on this show in a while. This project was kind of disrupted by the closure of school, but yeah, a very positive response. Not from all the kids. Some of the kids snoozed through the presentation, but some of them really caught fire. So it was very encouraging.
Yeah, stories and personal stories, and being able to tell your own climate story, and to, you know, have kids think about it in those terms. How has it impacted their family, their friends, their experiences? I think that's so powerful. And then that fact that you brought in older, you know, peers that are, you know, maybe they're called, you know, that much older, but they're still much, you know, closer in age than you or I are.
Right. Yes, right.
To them and who help them develop those stories. That's wonderful. That's a great thing.
Where would you go with some of the older ones? Maybe high school or the college students as well? How do strategies and actions change for those levels?
Right. You know, those ones, too, many of those ones, you know, at that age, and I'd say even at middle school, too, but, you know, in terms of their power with elected officials, with corporate accountability, so campaigns that help those young people through social media, through writing letters, through sharing stories, through visiting the state house, through visiting, you know, who do they support? What, you know, their shoe company or their t-shirt company or whatever, what are they doing to be more sustainable? And it is amazing when, whether it's our elected officials or brands, hear from young people directly how they can respond. So reminding them that they actually are powerful, that way they will get a response. In most cases, if you write your, you know, congressperson, your mayor, they have to get back. Somebody gets back to you. So that can be empowering. Similarly, you know, that with brands, with high school students or college students, there's big programs on divestment, which, you know, pulling endowments out of fossil fuels, targeting and looking at the causes of climate and how we can address them. So sharing those journeys, as you said, in terms of writing those stories, and those are all important things. Looking at it, you know, now we're seeing the impacts of climate justice, of injustice, of inequities. So those older kids really get that. They see it, and helping connect those, you know, intersectionality, that's a word that's used a lot, and a lot by young people that are involved in the movement. Those are critical. That's critical that we help them see that, and then what are they passionate about in one of those intersectional areas? Are they, you know, is it voting rights? Is it gun safety? Is it food security? All of those things are part of our climate justice, our climate crisis. So what is it that they're passionate about? How can we help them, you know, see the interconnectedness of all of those issues, and that they have a voice in raising attention about something they're passionate about that's connected to all of these things?
Mm-hmm. Your final chapter is titled Creating a Million Ripples from Me to We. Could you explain the philosophy and practice of that?
Sure. And I think I start that chapter by reminding folks about a moment in time for our planet where back in 1968 when the Apollo space mission left our near-Earth orbit, and, you know, we didn't have many TV stations, or we didn't have the kind of media we have now, and the whole world was focused on these astronauts, and it was the first time we saw our planet with a photo from space, and so we were all captured by that moment, and we went from, you know, me to here is us as a collective, this we. And interestingly enough, I think, again, back to the COVID-19 crisis and, you know, the unrest that we're experiencing now, that we're actually all paying attention to these same things, that it's not just a me. You know, we're so busy under normal, whatever was normal, I think it's something different now, but, you know, focused on me, and I am in a rush to do this or here, and life is so crazy and busy, and we're pulled in all these directions, that now we've seen the power of us, of the collective, of voices coming together, and we can do that on climate as well, and we must do that.
Yeah, we had a guest a couple of weeks ago, a climate activist, obviously, guest, and she said we need to get that same kind of attention with climate action that they've gotten with COVID-9. And it's part of it is that's all that was in the media for probably a week I mean, there were no other, I mean, there were other headlines, but really, really, I'd open my news source on my cell phone, and it was all COVID-9, and we need that kind of riveted attention.
Right, and unfortunately, with climate, because it's here forever, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's hard to maintain. It's hard for news sources to keep that going, but they hardly report on it. So
we need
to focus
more,
as you said, on parts of it, or you know, in phases, or our meteorologists, you know, when they talk about the weather, they can bring in climate trends. You know, that has to become a thing that's there on a regular basis. But you know, from me, from the actions that I can take, recognizing there are things that we can do, our individual steps, you know, that might influence somebody else, as we've talked about, you know, over the course of the show. But we also need to understand that we need systemic change. You know, we're talking about these things on justice issues, on COVID-19, we need big changes, but they can happen. And we can, you know, if we all make sure everybody registers to vote and everybody votes and everybody does that with climate in mind, and again, not on a partisan basis, or, you know, we all are more focused on really understanding how important water scarcity is and the impacts of climate on that, or, you know, what these bigger issues that require systemic change, that we go from me to what we can do collectively on these things, but not to minimize the impacts we can have as individuals as well, too. So I still think, even though, you know, we've gone so far down the road, we're at that cliff with climate ready, you know, very close to the edge, it doesn't mean that we can just step back, and we need to be conscious of what our own individual footprint is on our planet. What can we do, again, individually? Then maybe it's you and a group of neighbors, or you and your town, or you and the state, you know, that then can be amplified and done again and again. So I think when we're more focused on that ourselves, then we want to demand bigger things, and we can see that actually together we can make a difference.
I want to ask a little bit about discouragement, and you've really already touched on this to some extent. But clearly, kids are going to wonder if one person's actions can make the slightest bit of difference. For example, if you write to your local congressperson, often you just get a stock response back. In fact, letters that are skillfully designed so that they don't even respond to the issue. You be assured I will be thinking of you when I'm on the Senate floor, and I will take your concerns into my own. Easy to be discouraged. To say, what can one person do? Do you have ways to deal, particularly with kids, about that kind of discouragement or even hopelessness in some cases?
Mm-hmm. I think it's to show them examples of that one person that did make a difference. You know, when we talk about kids, you know, we've seen this Greta Thunberg effect, right, of this one young Swedish girl who inspired so many other young people. And, in every state and in many communities, there is that young person on climate that's actually having their voice heard. And actually now we're seeing that senator or that congressman wants their picture taken with that kid, and they want to be on the Senate floor with it. So, you know, there are those people in history that, and she's one of those ones, and there are many young people now like that in America and different places of the world. But it doesn't have to be, you know, like that. I work with an organization called Young Voices for the Planet, and they have short videos of young people that have made a difference in their community, you know, have changed laws to get solar panels be allowed on government buildings, have saved public land, have shut down a power plant. Individual young kids that can't vote, that are young, you know, in age, but wise in strategies and words, with the support of, so intergenerationally, with the support of parents who help them, grandparents, you know, elders that help. So I think we just have to keep going. And, you know, if you get that stock answer from your congressperson, keep calling their office. I was surprised to learn, and maybe, you know, you've heard this too, but I've spoken to a number of staffers of congressmen and women and senators, and they tell me that if they get three or four calls, these are, you know, in districts where I live in the Northeast, you know, there's a lot of people, but even if they get three, four, five, six calls, they're going to pay attention. And if they get more than 10 calls on a certain subject, that congressperson knows about it, mm-hmm. and it's taking time in their office. So we actually can, with a very small number of people, actually be heard. And then it's up to us to follow up. So that's one of our, the recommendations in the book that I have as well, too, is that we need to follow up. So it isn't, you know, one-off, I called them, I'm disappointed, nothing happened. Call them again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wonderful advice.
And inspiring.
And inspiring.
You've kind of rejuvenated us, I think.
Our guest on Ecotopia tonight has been Harriet Sugarman. She is the executive director of Climate Mama. You can check out her work and her blog at climatemama.com. And we also highly recommend her book, How to Talk to Your Kids About Climate Change, Turning Angst into Action, published by News Society. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
It has been my pleasure, and thank you so much for having me on today, and for all of your thoughtful questions, and for really caring about all of these very important issues that are so important to us as a society, us as a species, us as a country. So thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
I love you.
singing Father to Daughter. You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. At 6 tonight, it's Ginger Nichols with Radioactive, running till 7:30, an hour and a half of great music from Ginger. Next week on Ecotopia, we'll be talking with Jim Gruber. He's a professor at Antioch College of New England. He's done worldwide research in writing a book called Building Community, 12 Principles for a Healthy Future. And boy, do we need to build community here in Chico, around the country, around the world. This will be an important interview.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Be sure to visit our website for notes and recordings of recent programs, plus an ever-growing list of resources provided by our guests. The web address is ecotopiakzfr.com. We also welcome your comments and suggestions. Send us an email at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.